Dr. Adams will present to us, and he's going to explore more deeply our intersection with justice and our relationships this evening. And then we'll follow that with a time of conversation, and we will have a great evening together. We're so glad to have you with us again, Dr. Adams, and thank you for your leadership and the ways that you have been sharing with us. We're very grateful. Let's pray. God, as we gather, you know that there are so many things on our minds that we're concerned about, with rising sickness numbers happening around us, and there being so much concern. And you know that we carry with us sadness and grief over the fact that Thanksgiving may not be with those that we wanted it to be with. But God, we do have so much to be thankful for. And we ask that you would just help us to keep that focus and remember those things, and that health is one of those things that we need to continue to watch after so that we can continue to be thankful for that. And also in our world, there are so many things conflicting, and we are called to study and discuss issues of justice and how they relate to us so that we can live more fully into our faith in our world. All of these things are going on within us as we gather this evening. Help us to give you our attention and be thinking on the ways that you are at work within us and how we can live more fully in tune with you in our world. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Well, Anna, thank you for your kind words and just ongoing prayers for you and your family during this time. Just on gratitude for the special relationship that River Road Church Baptist has with the seminary. I treasure my friendships with so many of you. Grateful for Daniel's leadership, for my friendship with Scott and others. And so this is a special class, and I'm just sorry that we couldn't do it in person, but that's the world we live in. So I want to talk about our ongoing conversation about justice, but think about it in terms of our relationships. And want to put a few biblical passages on the table from both testaments. But as one of the things that is often asked of kids or adults is, you know, what does church mean to you? What does it mean to be a Christian? We're often asked, what does it mean to be a Presbyterian? And one of the things that I like to ask students, and when I've pastored in churches, I always like to ask the question, what did it first mean to you to go to church or to be a person of faith or to become involved in a church community? Like, what is your earliest memory of why you did that? Now, often the time is, often the statement is that, well, my parents brought me to church, and I got involved in the youth group and made some friends, and it was just a result of my family's involvement. And that was certainly the case for me as well. But if you think about something in your early time being involved in a church that had an impact on you, I'll share mine, and then you can let me know if there's you know, anything you want to share in that regard. I was born in 1970, and the one of the things that happened in the mid to late 70s is that there was a boycott in the Presbyterian Church and other denominations, including some Baptist churches, of the Nestle Corporation. If some of you will remember that Nestle, which is a Swiss-owned company, Swiss-run, has, especially during those years, was marketing cheap milk formulas to mothers in third world countries, in the two-thirds world. And this was a problem. It was a problem because it was cheap, and it was being bought, especially in Africa and in some of the countries in Southeast Asia, and mothers were not nursing. This is you for those of you who remember, or just using your awareness, that the water quality is usually quite poor in a number of these countries. So, and many women don't have the capacity even to boil water effectively. There was a lot of waterborne diseases that were spreading, and Nestle refused to continue to market it, and refused, despite some pushback. And one of the things that happened was a number of American churches, some in Europe, but mostly in America, decided to boycott Nestle. And so when I was a kid for about 10 years, at Halloween, if somebody offered a Nestle's Crunch Bar or a Toll House cookie, we had to say, no, thank you. At Halloween, if there was a Nestle bar offered, that we would say, no, give it to the next kid. All of us who were kids were like, oh, this is so weird. And sometimes we said it was stupid, but, it was explained to us why we were doing it, and the boycott worked. Nestle quit. It's started a couple of times since then, but at the time and currently, it seems to be the case that, most major corporations are being much more careful, and there's better worldwide oversight in this regard. I just say this to talk about the impact that it had on me. The collective action by a community of faith made a real impression on me. Churches and Presbyterians, and I would say Baptists also, we can be plotting. We can be overly obsessed with bureaucracy. We can major in the minutiae. But sometimes when it comes to collective action, and in the interest of social witness, our churches get it right. It recalls to me the famous declaration of Margaret Mead: never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So such actions as the Nestle boycott seek to model, however imperfectly, the example Jesus taught us, that we should never be satisfied with an unjust status quo, especially a status quo that perpetuates injustice to those on the margins. Now, I guess that one of the things that I want to say as we think about our relationships and in thinking about justice was it wasn't just the boycott itself, but as a kid, seeing the collective social witness by among adults, pastors, and others who I really respect and whose perspective I value, had a real impression on me. So the international effort did, but also just seeing how that played out in the local church. So whenever the question is made, what did church first mean to you? That's my earliest impression of what it meant to be a Christian, because I was a little kid, and it's obviously stuck with me in a profound way. So maybe we'll just take a minute or two. Is there anything anybody would want to share about maybe not just what does it mean, why do you go to church now, but why did you first go to church, and what particularly drew you to it? Did you have a similar experience or encounter or relationship that really had an impact on you in this regard? And it's fine if nobody has a story, but I just wanted to give an opportunity.
Well, I of course would say that my first response was family, just like you said, we went. But I remember as a young child, growing up in Dallas, Texas, that my part of Oak Cliff was dry, and my church decided that we would march in the parade with posters and whatever we had to fight to keep Oak Cliff dry. It worked and lasted for a very long time. So when we would go back to Oak Cliff in Dallas, I was shocked that that precinct was still dry, just as I, as a young child, you know what dry is? No alcohol. Okay, good.
No, I know I'm among Baptists, so absolutely I know about drugs.
Oh yeah. But I remember that I marched down Jefferson Avenue carrying a poster that said "Keep Oak Cliff Dry." I will not add more.
No, but it speaks to the fact that you saw fellow church members engaged in social witness, and it had an impact on you. And you still remember it.
I hadn't thought of this until Diane mentioned that, but growing up in Charlottesville, the high school there and one elementary school, the high school was one of the first five in Virginia to be integrated. And you never hear about it because it went smoothly. But before that, because of massive resistance, for one semester, the high school and one elementary school were closed. And so the question became, what do kids do? How do we school the kids? Well, a private foundation was formed, and they raised money to pay the teachers. And they needed, of course, spaces to play, so to hold school. So the recreation, the phys ed was held at the swim club. They took one class a week, a day rather, and the downtown churches opened up to house them. Well, it took a vote for each church to decide what to do. The Presbyterians and the Episcopalians and the Methodists fell right in line right off the bat. First Baptist, the first vote was against doing it. And it really was a dilemma. There was a separation of church and state issue because didn't want to usurp or do what the government's supposed to be doing. Didn't want to seem to be aiding and abetting the segregationists, but there were kids who needed to be educated. So what do you do? And so the first vote was on a Wednesday night and the vote was against it. Well, some of the folks who wanted to do it, who were, I don't want to characterize them, but there are people we didn't see at church very often, kind of rose up and said, oh, wait a minute. So there was a revote. And it happened on a Sunday morning. And there were all sorts of people I'd never seen before. And I was, I guess, 10 years old. And I had just joined the church the previous spring. So I had a vote in the congregational vote. And they were paper ballots. And we were to walk down the aisle and place our yes or no votes in a box, just like a ballot box. And on the second vote, the vote was to go ahead and do it. I was just listening to what my parents said. My parents said, no, we're gonna vote no. Even if it means keeping kids out of school, we're not gonna open up our church to avoid segregation. To avoid desegregation or to get enmeshed in political or of what should be a governmental affair. So that was the first vote I ever took in a church, in a Baptist sanctuary.
Scott, how old were you?
About 10.
Well, that's really cool. And clearly you remember it very well.
Yeah. I remember it was an N on the slip of paper.
That's a proud vote to cast. So here's a quote from Luke. Do not be afraid, little flock. We looked at this briefly the first week. It's your father's pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give alms, make purses for yourselves that don't wear out. Unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes and no moth destroys. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The Greek word for treasure here is thesauros. It's the same word from which we get the word thesaurus, meaning a treasury. Jesus is saying here that what we value in life determines what kind of person we are, and the material possessions are fleeting and ultimately inconsequential, that these are not treasures in the final analysis. My friend and Union colleague, some of you know, John Carroll, explains in his commentary on Luke's gospel, Jesus' words deliver a stinging rebuke of a culture two millennia later that all too comfortably fuses religious faith with pervasive commercialism and materialism. And I think that's right. So one of the things, you know, Scott's talking about is vote. If you could describe what, who was Jesus? Like, If you could describe Jesus as his job title, what was he first and foremost? I mean, we could get into the larger theological and sort of existential affirmations of Savior, Son of God, Son of Man. And those are all obviously of fundamental importance for us as people of faith. But if you could give Jesus a job title, what would you call him? What are some job descriptions that leap to mind?
Rabbi?
Teacher?
Healer?
Someone who reveals.
Someone who reveals. I think I was muted just then. So rabbi, teacher, healer, those would be at the top of my list as well. And then someone who reveals, and that's, say a little more, it reveals God's truth, God's message, very similar to a prophet. In the same way a prophet sort of communicates the divine word to the world, someone who reveals, that would also be a very central job title.
Anything sort of else? Like a messenger, which is the same, almost like a synonym of it, messenger.
Yeah, messenger.
Just a messenger.
All right, so I want to come back to the first one that was said, rabbi, teacher. And I would these are not mutually exclusive and they all apply. I think we can agree. But rabbi, teacher is probably the most pronounced role that Jesus has in the New Testament. And this comes in the context of a particular tradition that is operative within Judaism. It's called Midrash or interpretation. This comes from the Hebrew word meaning to seek, that you seek the interpretation. And there's a long tradition of this within Judaism that persists to this day. Some of you will have heard of the Mishnah and the Talmud and the subsequent Jewish commentaries on the Torah. The primary thing Jesus is engaged in the New Testament is interpreting or seeking the way to interpret the law. And it's a dialogical interpretation. We often assume within Protestantism that you read a passage from the Old Testament and it has one message or meaning, and it's up to Daniel or myself to preach that, or Anna, and we have to give the message. Isn't there even a Bible called The Message, I think, which would imply that there's only one way to interpret a text? And that's false. Text can be as Daniel showed us last week, text can be interpreted in many different ways. And there isn't necessarily one correct way of doing it. Jesus is engaged in a process of midrash, of interpretation. And that's why the Pharisees keep coming up to him to ask him X, Y, or Z in an effort to engage in this ongoing discussion. I want to show you an example of this because it's relevant to what we're talking about. This is from this is just kind of cool. All right. This is from a text from the Dead Sea Scrolls corpus called the Damascus Document. And this was a Jewish group that lived from the first century BC to late first century AD, CE. And so they were basically contemporaneous with Jesus. This was a different Jewish sect that retreated into the wilderness, that believed in an afterlife, that believed in they believed in messianism, meaning they believed in there would be a final judgment at which messiahs would be present. So quite similar to the community of which Jesus was part. This would have been a different Jewish sect, S-E-C-T. And they were engaged in the same process of Midrash. And this is one of their rule books. This is from the Damascus Document, column 11. No one should help an animal give birth on the Sabbath. And if it falls into a well or a pit, he may not lift it out on the Sabbath. No one should rest in a place near the Gentiles on the Sabbath. No one should profane the Sabbath for wealth or spoil on the Sabbath. Any living human who falls into a body of water or a cistern shall not be helped out with ladder, rope, or tool. No one should offer any sacrifice on the Sabbath. So this is a very, this group didn't play. They didn't mess around. If you fell asleep or guffawed at the wrong time, you were going to be in trouble. This was, you know, I'm trying to think of a good Virginia analogy. I mean, this is like first year of VMI seriousness about, you know, how are you going to behave in various contexts? So they're engaged here, this Jewish group, in an interpretive move. Now let's look at a similar passage. From the Gospel of Matthew, he left that place and entered their synagogue. A man was there with a withered hand. They asked him, is it lawful to cure on the Sabbath so they might accuse him? He said to them, suppose one of you has only one sheep and it falls into a pit. Will you not lay hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a human being than a sheep? So it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and it was restored as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. Interestingly here, notice the relationship between these two passages. It seems very clear that they're both trying to deal with the Sabbath laws in the Old Testament. And Jesus takes a somewhat more inclusivist, accepting view of how this is going to work. And so he is engaged in a dialogue with the Torah the same way that the community responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls is. And he's trying to there clearly were debates about how to interpret the Torah. Jesus almost always tilts in the direction of inclusivity, neighborliness, and special care for those on the margins. So there's an ethic of neighborliness that we find in the New Testament that is relevant. Now, we want to be careful that doesn't lead to assuming that all Jesus' Jewish opponents were hopelessly restrictivist and mean, and because that wasn't the case either. So we have to be careful about anti-Semitism in this regard, but it is the case here that Jesus is engaged in a really interesting debate that was clearly raging among he and his fellow Jews about what's lawful and what's not as we seek to interpret the Torah. Anybody have any questions about that? I know this is a slightly technical point, but see, Sam, anybody have any response or question?
Sam, I'm thinking that Jesus' companion and the combining of presence and being with, he says, follow me, and the teaching, and then speaking of inclusivity and neighborliness, it's all relational. It's not teaching at a distance or teaching in a sort of unconnected way. It's a being with, God with us, companion.
No, that's absolutely right. Jesus, His fundamental goal is definitely companionship and neighborliness in a way that is both profound and provide. But it's again, it's his rabbinic role as a teacher is predicated on a particular interpretation of the Torah, and I wanna lay this out here using another probably the most important example of how he does this in the entire New Testament. This is from Leviticus 19. Now, when you think of the book of Leviticus, your eyes glaze over, right? Maybe they do. You think, what do you think of when you think of Leviticus? What would you say, like if I said, what's the book of Leviticus about?
A whole lot of obscure, almost undecipherable rules.
Undecipherable rules related to purity, related to sacrifice, priestly regulations that have no bearing on our life. Anything else? Does that about cover it, maybe? All right. So it might surprise you to note, some of you know Sam Ballantyne, who attended your church for many years. He wrote a commentary on Leviticus for the interpretation series, which was published by Union. And one of the things he was able to show how relational it is, how community oriented it is, how much it is one of the more important books in the entire Bible for understanding community witness, neighborliness, and not a non-materialistic understanding of the world. And his commentary is exceptional in this regard. There was actually the definitive commentary on Leviticus was written by a guy named Jacob Milgram, who was actually a rabbi in Richmond for several decades. I don't know if anybody knew him. This was way, way back. in the 60s and 70s, but he wrote the definitive commentary on Leviticus. But here's a passage in this regard. Don't defraud your neighbor. This is from Leviticus 19. Don't steal. Don't keep for yourselves the wages of a laborer till morning. Don't revile the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall not render an unjust judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. With justice, you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slander among you, your people. You shall not profit by the blood of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Here, hang on. I've got to go a little bit further down. And then here in 18, here's the key verse. This is at verse 18. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So here's where we get loving your neighbor as yourself in Leviticus. Did anybody know that before tonight? That's where it came from? Well, if I've done one thing tonight, it's that. You now know love your neighbor as yourself comes from Leviticus 19:18. Don't forget it. And I'll put up our famous New Testament passage in a minute, but let's pause on this. So notice how the statement that you shall love your neighbor as yourself comes in a series of prohibitions that all relate to neighborliness, lack of materialism, and not cheating or defrauding or taking advantage of those who are vulnerable. And this is a longer passage, but it shows that there's great specificity in the Old Testament about what it means to be a neighbor. All right, now, what does it mean to love your neighbor? Let's you know, Scott says he likes to pay attention to verbs, and I do too. The word there is ahav. So aleph, het, bet, which means to love in Hebrew. But what do you think it means to love your neighbor as yourself, or to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind in Deuteronomy 6? What does love entail for you? Let me bracket that or start that off by saying, let me ask the question in a particular way. Do we have a tendency in the church to attach what I call a kumbaya, hallmark, syrupy, sentimental, stand around the campfire the last night of the retreat kind of understanding of love? I mean, is that sort of the definition of love we tend to project? I'm putting my hand on the scale for what I want to, how I want it to go.
I just say compassion. That's one thing I see that love is compassion.
It's compassionate?
Right, compassion. Yeah, compassion.
What else do you think, and particularly in the context of this verse, what do you think it means to love your neighbor as yourself? To have compassion, for sure, absolutely.
Yeah, you sort of, I guess this is an Indian phrase, American Indian, like walk a mile in my shoes or whatever. You know, if you're in that situation, what would you do?
Absolutely.
That kind of thing. That's sort of what I think it means. You know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, and that's what it means to me.
Sam, mm-hmm. I think that the examples you gave about around the campfire and the kumbaya and all that, that might be for other churches, but we have Daniel Glaze as our pastor.
So he's going to go deeper, right? Well, that's a good thing. I've noticed that about him. Absolutely. That he's not going to let it stop at, he's not going to let it stop at more of a mega preacher on TV trying to earn a few bucks kind of definition.
Why shouldn't love be partial to the poor? Not partial to the poor. I would think love would be partial to the poor.
Let me look at that. I had a question about that verse as well. Let me find that verse.
19:15.
You have to look at it in the context of that verse is trying to say, you know, Leviticus does extend partiality to the poor. I mean, it contains the Jubilee year law that says you should forgive debts every 50 years. It contains the sabbatical year law, which says you should, if there's debt owed by poor people on land, you should forgive that. I think this is trying to say, this verse is trying to say, try to be unbiased in your judgments and don't tilt one way or another. But when you take Leviticus as a whole, there is great advocacy for the poor. That one half verse shouldn't be sort of taken out of context. I think it's just trying to say, you know, try to be impartial in your judgment. But we have to think about the fact that there's a whole lengthy chapter in Leviticus 25 about tending to the poor, caring for the poor, not weighing the poor down with debt and excessive interest charges. But it's a good question. I want to stick with love, though.
Sam, could you say something about valuing, not having a hierarchy of the way you value your neighbor and you value yourself, the same realization of personhood? Your neighbor is a person too, as you are.
Absolutely. It's seeing, you know, the inherent worth and dignity of each and every person. I think that's a good way of putting it, that every person has and one of the things that is characteristic of Deuteronomy and Leviticus is that there is this collective entity known as the Israelites, and every member of this covenant community is deserved respect and is deserved an opportunity to live without oppression. Not only that, but the Israelites are supposed to welcome the resident alien into their midst, into the Passover feast. We're about to have Thanksgiving. You're supposed to welcome that resident alien to the Passover feast just as you would an Israelite. So there is a notion on valuing each person and the inherent value of each person. Now, I want to come back to love and the whole notion of what it means to love.
I was thinking you could have compassion sort of down to someone, whereas love is, well, maybe I, thou, in Buber's language. Right.
No, that's right. You don't have the same hierarchy in this regard. But the thing about the Torah, that's right. The Torah and the Old Testament and the New Testament acknowledge that there will be hierarchy, but you try to seek to minimize it as much as you can. So it deals with the world as it is, even as it seeks to make the world a better place. Now, I want to come back to this whole issue of love. The whole idea of loving your neighbor and loving God, both this passage and Deuteronomy, where you have the famous, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, these are drawn from the language of ancient treaties. Like if you make an agreement between yourself and the king or yourself and another nation, that love implies not just compassion, but total obedience. Total loyalty to the other person. That would involve a sort of selflessness and a selfless devotion that supersedes just sentimental attachments to somebody, but that would involve, financial, spiritual, but also time, the giving of one's time, just sort of a total loyalty to someone, a sort of pledging of oneself to a neighbor. So in other words, you say, when you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you can also translate it as you shall pledge yourself to your neighbor, just as you would hope your neighbor will pledge him or herself to you. I am the Lord. That in giving ourselves, our neighbor, our love, we would not just want to be kind to them, but we would want to provide for their needs, and we would want to be devoted to them as a member of a sacred community. So there's a sacred communal aspect to this that is uh, that, you know, in a sense, you know, a covenant is a treaty. And so this is treaty covenantal language in the sense that I pledge my loyalty to you. I pledge, you know, everything I have that could help you when you're in need, and I would hope you would return the same to me. And so Jesus certainly picks up on that. We'll look at a famous passage, and we can have some closing conversation. We won't have time to read the whole thing, but I wanted to put up the beginning of this passage, one that you all know. But it will emphasize Jesus as rabbi. A lawyer stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He said, what's written in the law? This is, again, I'm going to type it up again. This is midrash. This is interpretation. This is seeking the content of the Torah and seeking to interpret it for his listeners on this day. So he said to him, what is written in the law? What do you read there? He said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and you shall and your neighbor as yourself. He said, you've given the right answer. Do this and you will live. Now, what's Jesus doing here? Is there a verse in Scripture that contains both of these? No. He's engaging in Midrash. He's engaging in the Jewish tradition of interpretation. He is combining Deuteronomy 6, the Shema, which we, that's misspelled, sorry. The Shema, you shall love the Lord your God, the Lord is one, or the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 9. He is combining that, I want to spell right this time, with Leviticus 19, 18. This is a Midrash combination. This is what we might call an interpretive move Jesus makes in bringing these two texts together in a very brilliant way. So he takes one section from one book of the Torah, another from another, and says, this encapsulates what it means to be a person of faith. And this encapsulates what it means to be in community with each other in a non-materialistic sense. And then, of course, he goes on with the story of the Good Samaritan, which is, of course, in the spirit of the Torah, because it says, your neighbor is the outsider, your best neighbor, the one who shows best what it means to be a neighbor is someone who's on the margins. Samaritans and the traveler and the Samaritan in the story would have been on opposing ends of theological and political debates. The Samaritans were outcasts during this period, and so that's noteworthy. And it just seems to me that as we think about neighborliness, as we think about how polarized we are, just how deep the divisions are in our country right now and in our world, where we can't even agree on whether we should wear a mask in public, Luke 10, Jesus's teaching role as a rabbi and an interpretive teacher does a creative and earth, sort of a life-changing reading of two fundamental passages in the Torah, brings them together to say, love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And what he's doing is he's taking the language that we looked at from Leviticus 19, not just, that whole chapter and Deuteronomy 6 and saying, here's what it means to exercise neighborliness in a materialistic world. And I could go on about this particular passage and some of the specifics of the Good Samaritan, but let me stop and see if anybody has responses or questions on that.
I just had an interesting thought, because our neighbors happen to be a gay married couple. And I was thinking about these verses here, and I was thinking, to love God in the way he says and to love my neighbor as myself is easy for us to do, but it would be difficult for some other people to figure out how to do those things together. And I'm not sure how other people would approach that, but sometimes loving your neighbor as yourself, to some people that might be a contradiction, which it isn't for us, but just an interesting thought.
Well, no, that's a really good thought. It's an important one. And it makes a point that I forgot to make. You know, if you call me, I'm going to geek out with the languages, as I've done every class. The Greek word for neighbor is plaison, which means near one, in this passage. And one of the things Jesus is saying here in relation to the Samaritan and the traveler who is injured is that who we think our near one is actually someone who we might not expect. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, the person who Jesus is asking is saying, you know, the person who exhibits the most neighborliness to the hearers of this parable would have actually been far ones, not near ones. This is a somewhat intricate point, but a technical point. But the idea being that oftentimes our neighbor, you know, the person who exhibits the most neighborliness to us is the one who we would least expect to do so, or the one we are supposed to exhibit neighborliness towards is the one we would least expect to need to do so with. And so I think this story upends the notion that the only people to whom we should be neighborly are the people who live next door, to whom it might be easier to send a casserole over because they're very similar to us. Oftentimes our next door neighbors, especially in today's context, may be very different from us. And somebody made the really excellent point as well that, you know, it's necessary in a city like Richmond to try to reach across demographic and dividing lines, to try to exhibit neighborliness in a way that, you know, sort of, I guess, would, you know, move beyond the boundaries of our immediate social circle and try to reach out to those who are quite different from us. There's a really good book about this that came out of Union a few years ago called Global Neighbors that really tried to look at the parable of the Good Samaritan and what it means to be in neighbor, you know, neighborly to each other, both in our communities, but around the world. And one of the theses of the book is that it's no longer possible to think only of our neighbors as our immediate, the people we immediately come across. That, you know, if I have a pair of, you know, Nike running shoes on, or if I go through the Starbucks drive-in, I'm benefiting from the Vietnamese or Chinese woman who stitched the shoes together, just as I'm benefiting from the day laborer in South America who picked the coffee beans that I'm enjoying. So there's a sense in which we really need to think about global neighbor, being a global neighbor today, because we have a global interconnected economy. And, you know, how is that going to play out in terms of how we relate to each other?
And this Good Samaritan neighbor, again, there's that presence, that's being with, that companion. Somehow, I mean, we can't be all around the world, but how are we to be with our neighbors, present to them?
And notice also that we didn't really look at the passage, but the Samaritan takes the Samaritan is, you know, crosses the street. He crosses in a dangerous situation, and takes risk for himself, and in order to provide not just financial, but compassionate help. And then he goes back and settles the guy's debt. I should I should just point out that one of the cool things when we go to the Middle East is the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. The highway from Jerusalem to Jericho today is basically the same one that would have been, it's the same route that was around during Jesus' time. I mean, it's paved now, but it's the same. It is still kind of rough. There's lots of activity. It's not a place you would want to be after dark. And there's a wonderful sermon that Dr. King preached that, you know, how can we collectively as Christians and fellow human beings make the road to from Jericho to Jerusalem safer? I thought it was a really helpful way to frame what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. How can we work to make the road from Jerusalem to Jericho safer? And he meant that, of course, metaphorically. How can we work in our own communities to make the road from Jerusalem to Jericho safer? And, you know, however, you know, whatever your politics are, I would submit, and I don't know if I would get any disagreements, that, you know, we're failing pretty miserably at that during the pandemic, that we still have a lot of work to do in terms of how can we come together to make the, you know, the road from Jerusalem to Jericho safer during the pandemic. You know, that, I mean, there's clearly stories of heroism, of self-sacrifice, but we're not really seeing the kind of collective solidarity that Jesus and the Torah talk about that might lead us to confront this more directly. And finally,
Dr. Adams, this is Judy Collins, and I just had to speak up that Crossover Healthcare Ministry got its name from the whole story about the Good Samaritan crossing the road. And so in a very small way, I think in this particular time of so much separation of ideas and everything, and in the middle of the COVID world, Crossover has really tried to reach out to the groups. And we've had 41% of our Spanish patients with COVID. So it has been an incredible problem that our country and our city especially has had to deal with. So it's very interesting, a little microcosm where we're trying to do a little something.
Absolutely. And thank you for reminding me that. That would have been like the perfect Richmond illustration. And I know your church has a table every year at the Crossover banquet, if I'm correct, or at the fundraising event. Well, I know you do because I've seen you there. It is and that name comes from the Samaritan's willingness to cross over and to risk those boundaries. Well, Crossover has a near and dear place in my heart because of, as you say, of the work they're doing, and their primary patients are of Hispanic and Middle Eastern descent, and so there's a real effort to engage themselves. Well, I'm not going to toot my horn, but as some of you know, my wife is a primary care physician, and she sees patients at Crossover every Tuesday afternoon.
Wonderful.
And is it, it? She says it's the most meaningful time in her week. So you're right. The COVID numbers are much worse there. So appreciate your lifting them up. That's a wonderful way to wrap up how in Richmond we're trying to address these things. And you know, we still have a ways to go. Anybody else have closing reflections or comments on this? But I just kind of figured it would be useful to end with, you know, sort of Jesus's core teaching, which comes from him working in the same tradition as other believing Jews of his day, the creative way in which he combines Deuteronomy 6 and Leviticus 19:18. Now you know, where does that come from? It comes from Leviticus 19:18, combining it with Deuteronomy 6 in a creative, interpretive move to explain what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. And combining love of God and love of neighbor. There's a sense in which I've tried, and others have tried to express this in terms of a vertical and a horizontal, that because God first loved us and created us, brought us into a relationship with one another, and that God is described in the Psalms as a lover of justice, as a mighty king, that because God is a lover of justice, we are therefore obligated, because that's the vertical relationship, we're obligated on the horizontal to try, however imperfectly, to do the same thing with each other. So in a sense, this passage from Luke is combining the vertical of and horizontal in what I call a theology of obligation. That there is a There is a vertical relationship of God loving us and us loving God, but that has to play out in a horizontal way with how we relate to each other. So I think that's sort of the best way to think about justice and neighborliness today. Any final thoughts?
Sam, I have a compliment for you. You did for me tonight something that Sam Valentine couldn't do. How's that?
Oh, my God.
Diane and Bob and George and the others might remember the year that the sanctuary was being renovated. We had to have worship services in the fellowship hall. And we had what we called then in-gathering in August. It was a precursor to the Holland Lecture Series. And Sam was a lecturer one August. So imagine a hot August Sunday. And we're sitting in those straight back chairs. And Sam gave an hour-long talk on Leviticus. It all made sense as long as I was listening to him. 3 minutes later, I didn't know what he had said. Okay. But I do remember this. I remember the gist of it was, we may not understand why these rules were the way they were, but they make sense if you understand the other stuff that was going on. And the one I do remember is not allowing the whatever they called the indoor plumbing, the toilet, not to be inside the synagogue, whatever.
The temple complex, yeah.
The temple complex. There could be no waste disposal.
Right.
And he said, you know, there are even some fundamentalist churches that still don't have indoor plumbing because that,
yeah, that's true.
From Leviticus.
That's true.
Okay. But he explained that it was a sanitary thing. It only made sense that you just didn't have that indoors. So that was the only thing I could remember from Sam's talk. But after tonight, I'm going to remember the Leviticus
1918.
I almost forgot already. I'm going to remember Leviticus 1918. And Diane and Bob, the next time we're in a Sunday school class together on Zoom, when that subject comes up, I'm going to say, does anybody know where that really started? And one of y'all are going to answer me, right?
That's right. Everybody, this is your test. For those of you who know Sam Valentine, this is just kind of a cool thing. I know it's time to stop, but he retired from Union last year, and some of his students have just produced a book in his honor with a bunch of chapters from those who worked with him. I think I've got it, actually. Let me see. Now I say that, it may be at work. No, I'm not going to try to get up and go look for it, because then y'all will just sit there and it's time to stop. But anyway, you can find it on Google, or I'll email it to Anna. I can email you the link, because it's got some really cool essays from people you would know, like Mark Biddle, among others, myself, and some other Richmond names that you all would know. It's just cool because it celebrates Sam's career by those who knew him, and there's going to be a session at the Society of Biblical Literature meeting to sort of present. It's not a secret. It was a secret, but it's been presented to him now, so I'm not giving anything away. But just kind of a cool thing. So I don't think there's anything about commodes in the temple, though, in this book. So anyway, any other final comments?
One thing I would add is I really appreciate your theology of obligation comment, and your reference to being aware that the tennis shoes that you wear and the coffee beans that you drink are connected to you somehow. And when you think about our obligation to be a good neighbor, an awareness, more than an awareness of those kinds of things, is helpful. And it takes intention to actually care enough to be a good neighbor, to figure out where that's being done well, and care for neighbors in healthy, strong ways. I think it's a really big job when you think of it in those kinds of terms, but it is part of our obligation as followers of Christ.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I really, really appreciate it. And You're right. It's complicated and a big job. And it's not something we ever arrive at. It's just something we have to continue to monitor. Well, as always, it's always an honor and a privilege to be with this class and with your church, and grateful for your witness in the city, and also this is, you know, I get to speak to a lot of church groups. This is also one of the more lively, vibrant, and if I might say, funny classes, in the sense that people have a sense of humor in this class, which is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with having a sense of humor as we engage in talks about justice and neighborliness. I think one of the things that's been missing from our, and I'm serious when I say one of the things that seems to me that's contributing to our polarization is our inability to laugh at ourselves and laugh at each other and laugh with each other. That if we could recover some of that, it would be a great thing. So even though the topic is serious and the times are serious, it doesn't mean we can't have pockets of joy and humor along the way. So I appreciate that about this group.
We appreciate
that. That doesn't mean I have to laugh at every joke Scott tells, but I'll laugh at most of them.
We very much appreciate your sharing with us and your leadership, your time. It is enlightening and very helpful as we think through scripture and how it calls us to live. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you all for being here. We have a week or two away from TFC, and the next thing we will have will be our Starlight service on December the 9th, and a caroling on the plaza on December the 16th for any who are able to do that. It will be especially socially distanced and well thought through. So hope that you can join us for either or both of those.